Welcome back to Booked Up. It's the last day of February, that time of year, which was first designated Black History Month by President Gerald Ford in 1976. But it actually began 50 years earlier in 1926, when Carter G. Woodson, who founded an organization now known as the Association for the Study of African American Life and History, proposed that the second week of February would honor Black history. The idea was to coincide with the birthdays of both Abraham Lincoln and Frederick Douglass. Over the years, with the Civil Rights Movement, the tradition expanded to a full month. Since 1976, every U.S. president has continued the official designation Ford began, including a theme for the month. This year, the theme is Black Resistance. To help honor the month here at Booked Up, for our February book club, we are discussing the letter Martin Luther King Jr. composed in April of 1963 from his jail cell in Birmingham, Alabama. Joining me are two regulars and two special guests. We have conservative attorney George Conway and book publicist Ivan Lett. Our special guests today are Dr. Bridget Baldwin and Jonathan Metzl. Professor Baldwin teaches courses in critical race theory and criminal law. Her scholarly work has examined the intersection of the Ninth Amendment and social movements, as well as the convergence of race, class, and gender on welfare reform legislation. She is a professor of law at Western New England University School of Law. Professor Metzl is author of Dying of Whiteness, How the Politics of Racial Resentment is Killing America's Heartland. He is also the Frederick B. Rentschler II Professor of Sociology and Psychiatry and the Director of the Department of Medicine, Health, and Society at Vanderbilt University in Nashville, Tennessee. Let's dive in. Hey, everybody. So thanks for being here. It's a little bit unique this month. Our book club, we are reading something that's not exactly a book. It's a letter. I think it's probably been published in a bound volume before, quoted for years and years, but not officially a book. And I just want to add that disclaimer because last month when the January Book of the Month was this special committee report on the attack on the Capitol, I did get one listener criticizing, saying I was cheating. And so if you are that listener, this would be a good time to, you know, fuck off. Anyway, just kidding. Okay, so glad to have you all here, Bridget, Ivan, George, and Jonathan. I've already introduced you, so you don't need to blush. But what I'd like to do as we start talking about Martin Luther King's letter from Birmingham jail is to ask you each, when you first read the letter and how it hits differently now in 2023. So Bridget, or shall I say Dr. Baldwin, can you give us a little context for the letter and how you saw it then when you first read it and how you see it now?
Sure. And I want to redeem you for the person who corrected you last year. There is a book. It's called Why We Can't Wait. I think it was published in like a year after he wrote the letter. So there is a book with the letter as a part of that book. So there you go. You've been redeemed. if that helps.
Thank you. It helps me a lot.
To give a little context, I guess, about what was going on, right? We were in the height of the civil rights movement. It was a centennial year, right? I think the letter was written in 1963, and Black people had been emancipated in 1863. So 100 years, and the progression of civil rights was very slow, right? Very slow. We hadn't had any federal accountability. And so in Birmingham, particularly, it was particularly violent against African-Americans asserting their rights and, you know, lost promises and things like that. And so Fred Shuttleworth, who was the leader of the equivalent to the Southern Christian Leadership Council, I believe that movement was called like Alabama Mission for Human Rights or something like that. Mm-hmm. And so he solicited Cain to come down and say, hey, we need your help down here. You know, Alabama has the worst record of violence against blacks and they're, you know, all these broken promises. We want you to come down. And so Cain comes down with his nonviolent approach to advancing civil rights and with a particular agenda, which I don't think a lot of people knew that the particular agenda was actually to get arrested, to have folks get arrested and to bring national attention. And although the pivotal account of this event is probably the letter from Birmingham jail, it really doesn't get moved to the forefront until we have the Children's Crusade that follows after this. But in any case, he volunteers to get arrested, even on the back of the fact that, you know, he might not be bailed out, even on the fact that I think his wife is, you know, giving birth, you know, even on the, you know, banks of a failed demonstration in New York. He gets arrested and is being held in solitary confinement and gets smuggled this letter and this letter that was published in Alabama, Birmingham, I think, Times. And
when you say this letter, just to be clear, a letter written to him by clergy members.
Right. It was written by, I believe, Catholic or Christian and Jewish rabbis to him, kind of a public statement about how they didn't support the active demonstration and that, you know, black people, you're disrupting, you have outsiders coming in. And really what you should do is really wait for the courts, go into court and do it the right way. This is not the right way.
And to be clear, it's April 1963. As you said, he's gone down there, volunteered himself in this act of civil disobedience to be arrested.
Good Friday.
Yes.
Thanks, George. And the goal was desegregation, right? Is that kind of
they targeted desegregation and political or economic structure, an economic structure to dismantle desegregation, right? Because we get the 1954 case of Brown versus Board, and you know, when we get the slow progress of desegregating in all aspects of life.
Like all deliberate speed was the imminent right. of the day. I get you.
Right. And then you get Bull Connor and George Wallace, right? I mean, you couldn't have two better people, right?
What was that? Segregation today, segregation tomorrow, segregation forever.
Yes. So that's the backdrop upon which he writes that letter in response to these clergymen denouncing. And he addresses, you know, I think 4 points that they make about his presence in Birmingham.
I'm going to come back to you in a moment for your feelings, but just to circulate around our conversation. Jonathan, do you have anything to add about the context or your own interaction with this text as well?
Yeah, wonderful. Well, you asked me first, like when I first engaged it, and I certainly, of course, read it a ton in grad school. And I wrote a book called The Protest Psychosis that was about the racialization of mental illness, which this period of King's work actually was incredibly relevant. Now, I'll just say, first of all, that it is an incredible just piece of writing by itself. And so I'm so glad we're doing this because it is just a beautiful example of a kind of rhetorical argumentative style that honestly we just don't see anymore, which is empathize with your enemies as a way of putting pressure on your allies, which is really the rhetorical strategy that he's using here. But he does it in such, he's using the categories, like that he was responding to a letter from rabbis and priests and clergy. And so this letter is incredibly rife with religious iconography and examples and things like that. So it's just a, you know, by the end of the letter, you just think either you agree with King's position or you're a friggin' lunatic, right? It's such a beautiful piece of argumentation because it's so clear. And it does what we rarely do in the age of Twitter, which is it's not throwing shade. It's not doing any of our things we do now. It's like, let me hear what I think your concerns are. And then let me re-articulate these in ways that it makes me seem really sane and you seem like, if you don't agree with me, you're crazy. So I just think as a piece of literature for argumentation's sake, it's important. Mm-hmm. But then for my own work, I when I was writing the protest Psychosis, I was looking at the metaphors that King used, because he actually also uses mental health metaphors a lot of times in his writing. Mm. And it's the beginning of this phase, particularly in his sermons. Now this, the letters, it's incredible how it was written also, right? He wrote part of it on a newspaper that was smuggled out, and then some other pieces of paper that were smuggled out, and then a pad of paper that was smuggled out. So he's kind of writing this, let's just say, under duress.
and he doesn't have the opportunity just to jump in. Like, you don't, you know, right now, I know he wasn't putting it down. He kind of wrote it straight through based on the date he got the letter from them and the date he turns this around. But he doesn't have the benefit to look back at what he wrote four paragraphs ahead. Right. Unless he kept a copy. He's just going, and it all hangs together. There's not a lot of repetition. I mean, go ahead, Jonathan. I'm sorry.
No, it's unbelievable in that way. And I just say the last thing I'll say is, what he's doing is he's in a way in increasingly nuanced form, creating that moral and ethical foundations of the ideology of nonviolence in the American context also. Mm-hmm. And I think that's so important because, like I see it, what I use in Protest Psychosis is his unfulfilled dream speech, the last speech he gives at Ebenezer Baptist Church before he's assassinated. And he's basically empathizing with people who want to be violent, right? He's saying every person in us has a Dr. Jekyll and a Mr. Hyde. Every person, we live with a kind of ethical schizophrenia, and there's an urge toward violence and an urge toward nonviolence. And what's going to help us attain our aims in a more viable way? And so in a way, it's just interesting to read that 1968 speech against this 1963 work in relation to, like, what's the role of breaking the rules? What's the role? Mm. And he's saying something incredibly radical in both examples. But what he's saying is, what's going to get us what we want in a way? What's going to further our aims more? But also empathizing with people who just want to burn some shit down, basically, or something like that. Like, in a way, it's very empathic because he says, you know, every one of us, and he references in the 68 speech, he references, you know, effectively Du Bois's notion of a double consciousness, that to be restrained is to be what it means to be Black in America and walk down the street. Mm-hmm. But what he's saying is this is a strategy in a way. And so he's articulating strategy in a way that I think plays out over the last, I mean, it's such a loss that we don't have 30 more years of King's writing to see how this would have played out. But it really is, I think, a change in the way he articulates nonviolence in this 63 text that certainly plays out in really, really important ways.
Before I ask Ivan to address this as well, when you say it's a different way that he's articulating nonviolence, do you mean the steps he said about direct action? Are they different steps, or do you just mean the rhetorical devices through which he explains it?
He embeds nonviolence in religious traditions, in moral traditions, in Judeo-Christian traditions. And then in my work, he starts embedding them in the history of psychiatry, right? This idea of, 100 years before, there was an illness called drapetomania, which was Black people were crazy if they tried to run away from slavery and stuff. So he takes that history and he turns it on his head and he says, yeah, we all have schizophrenia in our minds. So he takes the traditions he's critiquing and then he refracts them. It's really incredibly refractory what he does, which is you think he's agreeing with you, and really he's saying the exact opposite of your entire paradigm. And so I think that using that to justify nonviolence as a means to an end, like here he's telling people to break the law, but he's doing it in a way that is incredibly embedded in legal and religious traditions. And so in a way, it's really how he's building the foundation under nonviolence as a strategy.
Well, I'm going to return to you later about this medical piece, because obviously that's your sweet spot too. Ivan, you can take any of the questions, how you met this piece, what you're doing now, anything to reflect on it.
Yeah, I think if memory serves, I first read this in high school. And the reason I'm doubtful is because I don't have a memory of really sitting down and engaging with the letter like I did this time around. It is, like Jonathan was saying, a really masterful piece of rhetoric. And, you know, the idea that you would argue with what he is saying really does make you sound like you yourself might be insane. I was instantly reminded again of the anti-racist activist Jane Elliott and the kind of work that she does. You know, she goes around and you know, speaks to crowds of white people and asks, okay, who here wants to be treated like a black person?
Oh, that lady, that white lady with the short, white hair who yeah. talks about the color of your eyes, that whole thing. Okay, yeah, I know who you
exactly.
mean.
Brown eyes, blue eyes.
Yeah.
And, you know, it that's to me what this letter is accomplishing, you know, asking the questions of, well, why should we wait when waiting is going to be never? You wouldn't want to be treated the way that black people are treated in this country. And, you know, I think one of the biggest things that comes back around for me on this, it does have to do with a recent book that I've been working on. And no, I'm not here to hawk my projects.
Oh, but go ahead.
Oh, I will. It's called Stayed on Freedom, The Long History of Black Power Through One Family's Journey, written by Dan Berger. He just published a piece today for Time called The Black Power Movement is a Love Story. And that word, or really lovingly, which is what King uses, actually, and love several times over, is really what stuck out to me in reading this, you know, many years later. I feel like this is perhaps one of his most quoted pieces of writing as opposed sure. to his sermons. Yeah. And, you know, those were the sorts of things that I pulled out and highlighted as I was going through, like, yep, I've seen this many, many times over. But again, the whole context of the letter itself was different for me when I really looked at it with the eyes of, ah, I know now more about the love that he's speaking of. Not that mm-hmm. I hadn't experienced the sentiment, the feelings of, you know, fighting for freedom, fighting against injustice as an act of love. The emotional value was certainly there for me, but I don't think I ever would have put it into words myself as love.
It's so interesting that you should say that, because that's one thing I noticed. You know, I read through it again today, I mean, for today, and I also listened to an Audible book of a reading of this. And the one thing I noticed was that passage where he says Jesus was an extremist for love. I had not noticed that. I'd noticed maybe almost all of this. So I think it's interesting how we're revisiting that. So can you tell me a little bit more about, say, Dan Berger's book? What was the title of it again? And how does he engage with this?
Yeah, it's called Stayed on Freedom, The Long History of Black Power Through One Family's Journey. And really, his book is a history of the Black Power movement as seen through the lives of two lesser known activists, Michael and Zahara Simmons. Mm-hmm. And so what he does is, you know, through tracing their personal story, he knows both of them. I met Michael, actually, which was wonderful when they came to town for an event a few weeks ago. But he goes through their lives and gives us a window into the ways that the Black Power movement was formed in the 60s, you know, changed and under certain circumstances in the 70s, went global, and then ultimately sort of began to peter out really in the 80s, in the advent of Reagan. But an important thing to note here is that, you know, King himself, I think, in his Drum Major Instinct sermon, you know, sort of de-emphasized the idea of focusing on one figure in the movement, and in mm-hmm. this case, himself, and being able to shine a light on the other members of you know, the collective of the movement who help make a band a sound. And that's really, you know, what I think King is getting at, of course, when he speaks about being an extremist for love or protesting or breaking laws openly and lovingly, because you're standing up to do it for not only yourself, if you are the one suffering injustice, but you're doing it in solidarity with others, others whose lives you may interact with directly and, you know, may see every day, but also people across the world who suffer the same kinds of injustices.
But he also says, too, that those laws are not laws. And I think that's important, too, that, you know, it's not that, you know, I'm just an extremist for love, which he is. He's also taking a stance to say that those aren't laws. If you enact laws that only one particular group of people have to follow and they have no help in deciding those laws, those aren't laws. They're not laws that we should follow.
Right. And I think it's important that he notes that a law can become unjust based on its implementation. And I fully agree with that.
And the whole process. I mean, I think one thing also I noticed as a lawyer reading it, as opposed to an undergraduate, is not just his definition of, you know, what is an unjust law in terms of the nature of the law, about the application, but also the lack of voting rights and not having had a voice in that really hit a different way this time. But let me ask you, George, when did you first encounter this letter, and how does it, as someone who has been part of the conservative movement and maybe at one time, I don't know if you still are, but I don't think you're a member of the Republican Party anymore, but at any rate, how you think your party or the conservative movement has grappled with or appropriated King, or, you know, just your thoughts personally and also as part of that movement?
Like Ivan, I mean, I don't remember exactly when I read the text of it. I do remember being familiar and hearing about it in high school, which was in the late 1970s. And that's what strikes me on reading it again and reading it carefully and reading it, you know, in 2023, struck me about it was when I learned about this, and I certainly didn't read it many years after I was in high school. I was either read it in high school or in college. That was less than 20 years after he wrote it. It was in the span of my short teenage lifetime. And now, you know, that's what it stuns me today, that it still has that resonance, because I would have thought that 40 odd years later, we would be in a better place than we are today. And that's just, to me, is one of the stunning things about rereading it. And also, it shouldn't be surprising, because it's a timeless expression.
And you say 40 years later since
40
you read
years
it,
since,
but it's,
the one, since yes. I would have been exposed to it, right?
Because yes. it was written 60 years ago, and you'd think we'd be in a better place.
Thanks for reminding me of my age. it's really, really quite remarkable that in this age where we are having these debates about how we should teach history, there wasn't a question in the late 70s that this was an important part of our history. Maybe it's because I grew up in Massachusetts and they were more liberal there. I don't know. But there was no question that what had happened, which seemed to me eons before, because I was 17 years old everything that happened in the 60s was in black and white and seemed like a long time ago when it really, really wasn't. There was just no question how important it was to teach and understand what had literally just happened in the United States of America. And now we've lost that in a way. We have people, you know, arguing, and this ties into the question of, you know, modern day republicanism, who are like literally would question whether or not things, this history, the history of what happened in Montgomery, the history of what happened in the entire South, the whole civil rights era, you know, is somehow not important or overemphasized in American history. That's what that's what really struck me. I don't know if I've articulated it well, but that's what struck me upon rereading it today. I mean, what's new is in a way not old, and what's old is not new. And we're repeating ourselves. We're playing the same, we're doing the same things over again. And we're, this shouldn't be as hard as we're making it, I guess.
I know what I'm trying to express. I feel that way too, because when I think about this, I think, separate and apart from this letter, which I want to say something about, and it's gorgeous writing and how it takes us on this incredible historical, emotional, and rhetorical journey. I also think that one of the most beautiful parts of American history is the history of the civil rights movement, and that I don't understand why this would, anyone would think this should be a footnote or a separate course. I mean, I know that we talk about the 1619 Project, and to the extent that there's another moment in American history, it seems to me that this movement and this leader is the beginning of American history in a different way. You know, we don't, and Jonathan, you want to jump in?
I agree with both of you. I mean, it really is ironic to think, and I completely agree with George, even 5 years ago or 10 years ago, the thought that this would be controversial, and certainly before the Trump election, it was just unimaginable. Like we had a progress narrative in our story, in our country, that went from this letter to Jesse Jackson crying when Barack Obama was elected the first time. And, you know, it's kind of like we learn from the past, and then it's a particular progress narrative. And now we're sitting here thinking, like, could you even teach this letter in at least 3 states and probably more? You know, could you teach this in Florida right now? And so the idea that this is controversial is that there was, as we were thinking everything was a progress narrative, there was another story. You know, there was that Tom Stoppard play, Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead, mm-hmm. Which was the story told by Hamlet through the lens of Rosencrantz and Guildenstern. Bull Connor had a story too. And that's the story we're telling now, which is American history is, well, the Bull Connor narrative. You know, he was down, but not out. And so we're still fighting this kind of thing. And in a way, the idea, the unassumed progress about not just equality, but citizenship, productivity, technology, all these things, really is in question now, because the thing that we thought was defeated through stuff like this actually turned out not to be the case, that history is a pendulum and we're rebounding in a particular way.
You know, as you're saying this, Jonathan, I'm thinking about how helpful it would be to have this letter, and I'll explain for a moment, in order to study the summer of 2020 and the George Floyd Black Lives Matter nonviolent protests that were met with police violence, because there's this conflation when pro-Trumpers are justifying the violent insurrection, the attack on the U.S. Capitol. They're always like trying to say, well, look at the Black Lives Matter protests. But those were nonviolent resistance that were met with police violence. And the idea of being able to kind of teach people the theory and what when it works and when it doesn't in practice of nonviolent resistance. And to me, back when I read this, and again, I think one of the key things that he walks through here is the purpose of nonviolent resistance to create or a direct action, right? Doing something, sit-ins or blocking thoroughfares or making it difficult for commerce to continue, for people to shop. It's to create tension. The tension may feel uncomfortable, but tension brings people to the table to negotiate. That's the purpose. It's not an end in of itself. And if you think about applying that lens to the protests around George Floyd, it was like, if we do not, and by the way, we all know that was a multiracial protest in various cities across the country. And the idea is if we do not put our bodies in the streets, even in the time of COVID, nothing will ever change. Not that it changed that much, but it changed a little bit. And that how many years of police brutality, and I guess many more years as we can see, does there need to be? And so that's why you need to have direct action. And you kind of look through this letter, and I feel that I feel that he really does explain that. And I think it's really important to see. And I also think why this letter feels like a gut punch, too, is there's never an end to the white moderate. What, you know, especially in the Democratic Party, saying you got to wait. Jonathan, you're signaling to me that you have a thought.
Well, I just before we get to the white moderate, I just want to say one last thing about this point, which is I also think it challenges us to ask if these methods are still effective. And so I also think that there's a strategy. And the reason I say that is because like this logic, King's logic here has also been used in conservative circles. The logic of self-defense was used by the Supreme Court in the Bruin case to overturn gun laws in New York and other places. And so in a way, this strategy, I don't have an answer for this, but I would also say that before we move on from history, that I also think it challenged us to say, are these strategies effective? Or was it the fact that they were so radical in the 60s? Nobody was doing this in the 60s. And now this, it's kind of like MLK Day itself in a certain kind of way. It's become so, you know, the meaning has been changed because it's been taken up by a lot of white people, basically. I was trying to think about political way to say that, but that's what I mean.
Ivan's nodding, and so I'm going to let him talk.
The word is whitewashing.
Yeah. Okay, that's what I mean. And so this language and this logic is now used to justify a bunch of stuff that King would never agree with. You know what I mean?
Can I break that down? Are you saying, I guess there's a bunch of stuff. There's one, does direct action even create the necessary tension to bring people to the negotiating table to make change, one? And two, is it even effective because it's been appropriated by dominant culture? Is that what you're kind of saying?
I just think it's important to know that when this was being done in the 60s, nobody had ever done this before. It was completely radical. I mean, they had, of course, and, you know, Gandhi and all that stuff. But I'm saying in the U.S., to meet hate with love was, you know, and I just think that in a way, this message has been commodified in a certain kind of way. And so I guess the question is, if you did the same thing now, or do we need new tactics? That's my question.
Bridget,
I don't have an answer.
You're jumping in. Yeah, I can see.
I think that the part of it is that it's direct action along with media presence, right? So if you think about it, it took the images of the high schoolers being mauled by dogs and hoses to get the nation and the world to take notice, right? And it took the killing of George Floyd on camera to get the world to take notice. I like the word that Ivan used, whitewashing, because King and his speeches have been whitewashed, right? He was really a socialist, right? His favorite author, I think, was C.R.L. James, and he believed in labor movements. And I think what we allow conservatives to do is to control the narrative. And when we allow them to control the narrative, then you get this other thing that functions in a way that we didn't intend to do, like reverse affirmative action and stuff like that. I think also that what the speech does for us today is it highlights the persistent struggle that we have with police, right? We have Bill Connor, who's the head of the police force and the police force, the militarization of police forces now. And so it highlights the struggle that we have with police and the significant role that police play in stamping down whatever social movement there is, whether it's, you know, Black Lives Matter or the civil rights movement. And we have a long history of criminalization of constitutional rights. That's really what we're looking at, right? The criminalization of constitutional rights, different freedoms and that we're looking for. And then that the front line is just criminalization.
I want to just jump in and read just one passage because it feels like a violence to talk about his work without voicing it. So gorgeous. Let me just read something because it relates to what you just said, Bridget. And this is kind of in the part of the letter where he's talking about Socrates and civil disobedience and the Boston Tea Party being a massive act of civil disobedience. And he says, and this is kind of why we can't wait. But when you have seen vicious mobs lynch your mothers and fathers at will and drown your sisters and brothers at whim, when you have seen hate-filled policemen curse, kick, and even kill your black brothers and sisters, when you suddenly find your tongue twisted and your speech stammering as you seek to explain to your six-year-old daughter why she can't go to the public amusement park that has just been advertised on television and see tears welling up in her eyes when she is told that Funtown is closed to colored children, and see ominous clouds of inferiority beginning to form in her little mental sky, and see her beginning to distort her personality by developing an unconscious bitterness toward white people.
Yeah. Why we can't mean,
still the story.
It is. I mean, it is a different experience to walk down the street in this country. And I think one of the most difficult but important things is being able to recognize that someone else's experience is different than your own. That is not to say that they should be, that one person should be treated better or, you know, receive more privilege in a certain kind of way. But we are human beings. We are discerning creatures. We have to find some way of being able to acknowledge coexistence.
I think it's also pointing to the fact that it's easy for you as an observer to sit back and wait and sit back and ask us why we shouldn't wait for the progression of the court systems or for our rights to eventually come. It's easy because none of these things are happening to you. And if you had to undergo these things that I'm enduring or my people or my culture, whatever the case might be, then you would see why we can't, we have to do something to draw attention to make this happen much quicker.
You mentioned it's so interesting when he talks about his daughter. The next thing is about his son as well. I think he says something like, and then having to explain to my son when he asked daddy why are white people so mean to us or something to that effect.
Yeah, why do they hate us? Yes.
Any parent or anyone who's been a child knows what that is. You mentioned at the beginning, Bridget, that his wife was maybe about to give birth again at that time.
I think at the time that he was down in Birmingham, she was actually giving birth or had just given birth to their fourth child. Because that was a big deal about him being there and being isolated from her and her not knowing, is he alive? Is he safe? And let him know about the baby and things like that. Yeah.
Well, to me, when I also look at this letter and I think, okay, this is 1963 and we know in 5 years what's coming for him, which he obviously always knew was waiting, that potential of an assassination. But I'm also thinking of, the letter that was written to him from the clergy, they were saying, you're saying you're advocating nonviolence, but you're stirring people up and there will be violence. And, you know, it reminds me of, Spike Lee's film from the 90s, or Do the Right Thing. Is that the 90s? You know, and this sort of tension between you can the Malcolm X discourse versus the MLK discourse. In this moment, you know, for those, spoiler alert, you should see Do the Right Thing. But I'm just going to tell you this. Okay, this is now, fast forward like a minute or something, because I'm going to talk about the ending. But there's a moment. Have you all seen that movie? Okay, good. At the ending where there's this guy making this decision, you know, it's in a city uprising and trying to figure out what to do. And there's this moment, is he going to take the nonviolent path? And he's got this garbage can or something and he just throws it through a window. And you can understand it, though. It's not the best choice, but you can understand that. And so I wonder how do you read this letter in 1963 in light of Watts and in light of the uprising in Detroit? I'm from Michigan, so I'm always bringing things back to my state. And, you know, I think some of that stuff was inevitable. And I think the so-called white flight blaming it on the, you know, quote, riots was inevitable because that was a form of for choosing segregation. But I don't know. I don't know how. I guess I'm throwing a lot of stuff in here about the inevitability of violence. George, sorry,
yeah,
George.
No, what you just said and what Bridget just said a few minutes ago, to me, dovetail. I think that, I mean, the things that made this letter, what made this letter so effective, apart from just the brilliant rhetorical construction of it, what made it effective was the response to it, was the violent response to it, and the fact that it was on television and you could see it, and you could see what the, you know, you could see the fire hoses and the dogs, and you could see all of that, and then the moral clarity of the letter. And in a sense, to go to what you just said, Jen, the eight clergymen he was responding to, that King was responding to, weren't wrong in the following sense. There was a potential for violence. What this nonviolent, these nonviolent actions, the sit-ins and the marches, were quite likely to trigger violence. And their point was, that's why you shouldn't do it. But that's also what made it effective. Because he, in a sense, I'm not going to, not suckered, but he showed the Bull Connors of the American public and to the world, he showed everyone who these people were. And he did that, you know, by we're just, you know, we're nonviolent, but look what they do to us. Mm-hmm. And that was really what, one of the things that made, you know, that's why this the letter became so powerful. After it was written, it was after people had seen all these images. And then, you know, you go and you read the letter, and to talk about, you know, Jonathan talked about how it was constructed. It's brilliant. It sucks you in. You know, he's empathizing with the pastors who actually empathize with his cause to some extent, and he praises them for that. And then he works his way into the, you know, rebutting points methodically with short sentences. And then he goes into this long peroration where the sentences are like 500 words long, talking about all the things that were done to people, including his daughter and his son and everyone else. So the power of it really is the contrast between, you know, the sharp moral contrast between the fire hoses and what he's expressing. And I think I think that's the story of this letter. Right?
I also think that we would probably be naive to think that he didn't think that his nonviolence approach would bring violence, right? Because they prepare for that as one of their tenets, right?
Right, purification, right?
Right.
Sorry,
right.
Go ahead. Sorry to cut you off.
No. I couldn't think of the word anyway, so I'm glad you said it. you know, he goes through this notion that, you know, you're going to be, you know, bit, and you're going to be hit, and you're going to be spit on, and you have to be able to take it. So I think we would be delusional, really, to think that he didn't expect that their mere existence provokes violence. Their mere existence, the mere fact that we are asserting something. I mean, you know, I teach this letter, actually, in criminal law. And so we talk about, you know, the whole approach to, you know, unjust laws, right? But it was their mere existence, you know, not fighting against the status quo, which would, you know, incite the violence itself. And so he knew that, and he was very prepared to accept that and engage that.
So, and that's the lesson that's part of the lesson for today. I mean, the question earlier was whether or not this methodology, this approach, the nonviolent protest approach, Dr. King's approach, has meaning today, even though it's co-opted by other people with other causes. I think there is, you know, there are other morally justified causes where this is the right approach, where this has to be the right approach, because we don't want people to engage in violence to affect their political ends. And, you know, I think he kind of created a sensible rules of engagement here, for nonviolent protest. I mean, you have to be, first of all, you have to have a just cause, right? Or at least one that you truly believe in. That's not, you know, that you believe in. The second is you. It doesn't necessarily mean that you're you're breaking the very laws that you say are unjust. I mean, you know, that's when you in the sit-in and the counter. That would count there. But also it would mean, you know, lying down in the street to draw attention to the merchant next door. You know, that's, you know, the state absolutely can say, don't lie down in the street. But you, if you're willing to face the consequences of being arrested for violating that law, which you indisputably did, there's, you know, you have morality on your side as long as you are not yourself causing harm. And I think of this, for example, like, you know, you have protesters at the Supreme Court, right? It's illegal to lie down and park yourself in the, you know, on the plaza of the Supreme Court. And different people do it for different reasons. If you, you know, some people do it with coat hangers that say, you know, they support Roe. Other people did it with, you know, might do it with pictures of fetuses to say that they're against abortion. But if you're willing to sort of take the consequences and you're not causing harm, like you're not, for example, you're not lying down in the driveway of an emergency room ambulance entrance to protest the hospital's wage policies or something, and you're doing it and you're not engaging in violence yourself and you're not harming anyone, and you're willing to take the consequences, face the consequences, the legal consequences of violating a law, even if the law is otherwise just, like, you know, you can't lie down on the street. That's okay. That's morally okay. And that was completely novel. That was absolutely, mm-hmm. I think, as someone was pointing out, that was absolutely novel. And now we kind of accept it as sort of like, yeah, that's right. That's exactly how you're supposed to do it.
It totally made sense. And something you said about a just cause made me think two things. One, just to repeat, what he says in the letter is, in a nonviolent campaign, there are four steps. The first is collection of the facts to determine whether injustices are alive, then negotiation, then self-purification, and direct action. And as we said, self-purification to him meant training on not reacting if you are attacked. Now, I was thinking, as George was talking about, you know, when it's appropriate, when it's not, I was thinking recently of the ways in which some direct actions can undermine your cause. For example, those teenagers who were throwing soup on paintings in museums because the museums were funded by big oil interests,
yep.
And they were trying to draw attention.
That's destructive, though.
Well, hold on. They're trying to draw attention to climate change, and they're saying it's not destructive because there was plexiglass on the paintings. But it's idiotic because what they were trying to draw attention to was, why do you care more about this painting than the planet? And it's just kind of like, it's detracting, I think, if you do certain kinds of direct action where you're trying to tell people something that's valued, like art or what have you, needs to be subordinated to something else. You're muddying, I think, sometimes up your cause. And so I think at the heart of this is one thing I don't think he's mentioned is not just deciding whether there's an injustice, but deciding whether the direct action is narrowly tailored. No, is tied to the injustice enough that you're not distracting or adding another factor that's going to alienate people who might otherwise support your cause. Jonathan.
Well, I think that's important because that's another point of comparison, right? Is it, we've said moral clarity a number of times in this conversation. Mm-hmm. And I think I guess one of the questions I keep thinking is it possible to have moral clarity in the present day? Like in the present day, it would be tweets from the Birmingham jail. And half the people would be...
That's just so horrific, but go ahead.
And half the people would be supporting it, and there'd be a powerful counter narrative that half the people would be whatever. So the idea that there's one, that you can create the kind of distinctions right now is so complicated because in every single thing, there's like nine, you know, the idea of having this kind of clarity is hard. And then of course, another important distinction in the present day is just, the perception of violence is coded as violence, right? I'm thinking about stand your ground laws, for example. So in a way, just the idea of feeling threatened, which is something, of course, that DeSantis is doing and other people. So the idea that basically there's a distinction between violence and nonviolence is much more complicated in the present day.
I see what you mean.
And so in a way, it's just that when I said before, did I think the strategies would work or not? It's just that the category of moral clarity versus the good guy versus the bad guy, it's just much harder in the age of social media and our perception of what nonviolence means. I mean, I always think about stand your ground laws because in a way they're the precursor to...
Can you elaborate a little bit? Because I can unpack in my mind what you're saying, but can you kind of stretch out how stand your ground laws have blurred the distinction between what it means to be nonviolent or violent?
It's a very racialized sense that the perception that you're being threatened leads to justifiable violence, right? So in stand your ground, the idea that someone might threaten you leads to a justifiable means of, you know, even if the person just has Skittles.
Like Trayvon Martin with Skittles, just by being a young black man was a threat, therefore you can kill him. I'm not saying that, but that worked.
That is the logic of stand your ground, right? The perception of violence, and you know, it's not exactly the same thing, but the perception of being threatened or critiqued in a school in Florida right now is leading to. I mean, there's a lot of things about things being perceived as violent if they're racially coded that is just so different right now. It's really so different, and it's not a progress narrative, unfortunately. And so I just think that it's important to think about what nonviolence means in the context of America right now. And it's not the clear line that it used to be in a way, is part of what I'm saying.
Ivan.
Yeah. And much to that point of, excuse me, of, you know, sort of the distinctions being complicated. And at this point, going back to what George was saying, you know, we don't want people to accomplish their means through violence. There's a little bit even further of a separation you can draw there between what is physical violence, which is for the most part what we've been talking about, but there's also legislative violence, you know, outcomes that affect people's health, their livelihoods, their ability to live. And that often does result in physical harm. And so, you know, it feels as though nonviolence would still have to stand as the only counter to even legislative violence, and you know, certainly with the determination of unjust laws. But it's not working in the same way anymore, and it's not curbing the kind of legislative push to, you know, either disenfranchise or reduce access to, you know, in any number of services. What else could possibly be done other than nonviolence?
Is that a rhetorical question?
I wish it were. I really want there to be an answer that is not violence. But it feels as though if we're continuing to constrain the efficacy of nonviolence, who knows?
I mean, I guess, Bridget, go ahead.
You know, so much to unpack in all this. I had to like write down notes as you guys were talking. Because I think that, you know, he, even in the letter when he writes in response to him being, I think, called an extremist, he talks about, hey, I'm the mediator. My nonviolence approach is the mediator because you have those who are complicit, who benefit from segregation. We got the Black Power movement going on here. And I think it's funny to look at nonviolence approach of demonizing the victim, so to speak, right? So you're looking at Black people as victims, victimization, and talking about their approach as opposed to what they're responding to. And I think it's important to continue to include what they were responding to in an analysis of a nonviolent approach. Also, I don't think that a nonviolent or my approach to how I want to address my grievances should be defined how you or society thinks I should address my grievances, right? Because I'm the one who's in that grievance and you're not. And it might not be important to you whether or not I can sit at a lunch counter because you can. Or it might not be important for you for these other things because you can. The other thing is that I don't think we should discount a lot of the Black Power movements, Malena Karenga's movement, Black Panther Party, they initially started out as a self-defense organization. And so the violence that we couch them within is, it should be couched under this umbrella that, hey, we're defending ourselves. We're not proactive with violence. We're defending ourselves.
Yeah, I mean, all of that is a good point. I guess I'm stuck on, I want to hold some space for this idea that we don't know the ways to accomplish our goals, assuming that we all share the same goal. Let's just say for a moment that we all believe in equal opportunities and even inequality of outcomes. I mean, a fair society, you know, for shared prosperity, multiracial democracy, and all of that. And I also, though, now want to kind of turn to, as we start to wrap things up, the problem of the white moderate as he saw it, which we did touch on it a bit, and also Jonathan in particular, your more recent book, Dying of Whiteness, and how that means for me, it doesn't bode well for the average white person, I don't even know how to say that, for the typical white person to share the same goals that we might all share in this conversation. So if people are willing to die before they share prosperity or access to health and all these things with people they don't want to share it with, what will possibly work?
I mean, the critique of whiteness and of the moderate white in this 1963 letter is really, it's just incredible, honestly, that somebody wrote this in 1963, because he wasn't just saying, basically what he was saying is, Bull Connor, I know where he stands. KKK people, I know where they stand. People who say they're allies with us but then don't show up, those are the people that I find much more terrifying. And so in a way, it was a critique of virtue signaling in a certain kind of way. It was a critique of not just the obvious white people and the kind of good, bad binary that we've been talking about. But So the fact that he kind of works that in over a couple paragraphs, that really, I know where my enemies stand, but where does my friend stand, is a pretty deep point, I think. It's a pretty deep point that really ties to this question of kind of how far are people willing to go? And I certainly saw that when I was researching my book, Dying of Whiteness, particularly around gun policy. It was really interesting interviewing people around gun policy, because a lot of people were like really openly toting guns, and they were very, Mr. Gangbanger might come and carjack me or something like that. And that's why my AR-15, it was scary. The guy had an AR-15, but it was kind of like a predictable stereotype or things like that. But then there were other people who like told me up and down, like, I'm against gun rights and we shouldn't have this stuff. But then I looked at the data and like a lot of people, like a lot of white moderates, for example, wouldn't vote against gun policy. There were all these ways in which people were really good at signaling, but they weren't good at like really instilling the institutional change that was needed. Mm-hmm. And so rereading this too, I guess that's another kind of rhetorical question, is his critique of white allies, how much does that hold true also, right? And I think it's still a challenge, right? That we can shout out the Bull Connors on social media, but really the question is, what are we all playing in creating that world that, Jen, I think you're right, we want to get toward.
I think more people, more white moderates need to read letters like this, but, I think it kind of invites the question of the now what. I mean, I think we're all looking at this, it's gorgeous. He was an incredible leader. And I think about, who is an equivalent voice today, you know, someone who is outside of government, but a thought leader. Any ideas on who you think is, and I don't mean copying him or doing what he's doing, but who is another leader who is pushing toward goals of social, racial, and economic justice, who you think will be looked back on, hopefully in 60 years, where we don't say, oh, we've backslid, but has been effective in moving things forward. I'm not saying, I should be more clear. Obviously, between MLK and then Lyndon Johnson, we did get some legislation passed, let's face it, but it's gotten rolled back by the court, especially voting rights. I mean, reading this, you know, I guess I'm saying a bunch of things, but to me, the biggest challenge right now is voting and voting rights, because I think until that changes, we can't change policy, but how do we get to that place? And then separately, the question, I mean, I have Ta-Nehisi Coates in my mind because of reparations, but you maybe have other folks. Ivan, do you have ideas on this?
No, and only again because it's so hard to focus on one person when there so many people doing this work.
Thank you. Then how about people?
People. Oh, I mean, everyone who, you know, gets up to protest, everyone who has been, you know, going around for collecting census data, people who literally put their bodies on the line and into motion in order to accomplish a goal. And I think that's something that easily gets lost sight of when we sort of collectively talk about things as, you know, one person or even just a movement. That movement is made of so many different moving parts. There are always so many different organizations, acronyms that I can't even keep track of. But these are all happening in local, community, grassroots level types of action. And we have to remember that it is pervasive and it is everywhere. The progress is slow, but people are working.
You're so right. I mean, my first person I interviewed for the podcast was my friend Dahlia Lithwick, and Lady Justice makes this point. You know, don't just go out and buy the RBG mug. That's not the point. She did not want that, and that doesn't help any of us because it takes all of us. Bridget, do you have thoughts on this?
Yeah, I definitely agree with Ivan, and I even think if we look back on the civil rights movement itself, the narrative got control to push people forward, but it was a lot of people working together who didn't get recognition, who didn't get credit to push things forward. You know, a lot of people the Black Lives Matter movement has been global. And even though maybe their trajectory is different or what they're pushing for is a little bit different than the things that were being pushed for, we have, you know, Latino people, Asian people, a lot of groups organizing. And so I agree with Ivan that, you know, it's everybody working together towards this, you know, one goal, whether it's equality or equity. I guess that would be the question.
Look, I mean, I think there's just a lot less moral clarity today because we're not talking about, you know, segregation, pure segregation, pure de jure segregation here. We're talking about things that are a lot more, I mean, at least to me, ambiguous than what was at stake in 1963. I mean, which again speaks to that's the power of the letter, was its context. Today, there isn't as much, you know, George Floyd was a perfect example of something that did have moral clarity because we did see the video and we saw that. But there's just a lot of things when you're talking about equality of results, for example. I mean, you know, there's a lot of, there's much more to say about that, about, you know, what legal methods should be used and what equality means in the context of opportunity versus results.
Right. I was trying to be provocative there.
Then, right. Because, you know, you're just being your liberal self. It's okay. you know, it's not like lunch counters. It just isn't. And I think that's part of the problem. I think if there's a problem in the efficacy of the method, I think as Jonathan was talking about before, is that you don't have that level of moral clarity. It's kind of like, this is totally different because it does involve violence, but Ukraine, it's like, we've had all these wars, you know, and Some of them were, was it really, were we really doing the right thing in knocking out Saddam to get something maybe just as bad? Or, you know, with Ukraine, there's no moral ambiguity about it at all. Which is like, it's like you have the just war. It's the perfect just war. And that's what
I can help you out.
1963.
I can help you out now, though. What about this? Okay, this is going to be super cool. I think I can do this. So there are moments of what you might call moral clarity. Right. We could say slavery. We could say Jim Crow. We could say what was going on, the de jure segregation. We are still living in the legacy between the black wealth gap, how people are treated. We're still living in that, and that hasn't been redressed. I think there's some moral clarity there. Anyway, sorry, Jonathan, what were you going to say?
And the killing of unarmed men.
Yes.
I'll let George finish first.
Sorry, George.
Well, I just think, I mean, the moral clarity, you know, there is moral clarity in what you're talking about, except what's the remedy? I mean, are reparations the remedy? I mean, why should, you know, I mean, okay, so I'm part white, I'm part Asian. I don't think my white half, they had anything to do with slavery because they came from, you know, Ireland in the late 19th century. And I certainly, you know, and half of me, my mother came from the Philippines in the 1950s. So it's like, why am I paying? Why would I pay reparations?
We benefit from whiteness.
You benefit from this institution.
Well, I don't know. Well, again,
I hear what you're saying. The reality is,
and everybody, and you know, in this world of where, I mean, frankly, most of us are mutts. Or at least that's the way I view myself.
I'm not a mutt.
How do you?
I'm literally
the reparations.
There's nothing interesting. I'm like 98.9% Ashkenazi.
You're
going to
write the check.
I'm happy to. Our town, by the way, you laugh about this. My town in Northampton is going to do reparations. I'm glad to participate in that.
Okay. Well, but again, you know, but my point is really, it's just a lot harder and there are a lot more counter arguments that are legitimate moral arguments than they were with, you know, whether a 9-year-old girl has to drink a black girl has to drink from a different fountain. I mean, it's just not.
But doesn't that get to the question of scarcity in our society? Why do we pretend there's scarcity when there should be a baseline? There should be people's needs. Anyway, this is a separate conversation, but I love that we're even trying to have it, George, and we have to continue this until I beat the truth into you. I mean, nonviolently. Yes. I'm teasing. Okay, yes. Jonathan.
No, it's okay. It's okay. That's what this is, but this is important. I mean, this is
Yeah,
actually,
no, I know this. Yes, we should.
Right. Jonathan, we're coexisting.
I feel like Fox News. I mean, you know.
Exactly. No, I mean, this is, but honestly, no, this is no, what I wish we were talking about. Right. Jonathan. Right.
I also think I think of all the times where, think about the moments we've had moral clarity about the issues King raised in this letter, right? And how long that lasts. Remember that Atlanta or Georgia was the first real voter suppression kind of deal there for a while. I mean, there was a lot of it otherwise going on, but all of a sudden everybody mobilized, you know, if you're going to mess up Atlanta, everybody was saying like boycott Delta and boycott all the businesses that are based in Atlanta. And they, you know, part of this, you know, remember they like moved the All-Star game or something like that. I mean, there were all these things happening. And so in a way that lasted like 5 minutes and then something else came and then other places started doing voter suppression and then you couldn't even keep up with who was doing it. And so I just think we've also exceeded the capacity almost of the human brain to kind of say, here's a geographical location where one thing is happening, because even the things that seem clear cut, they don't sit still the way that they did in the 60s. I'm sure it was really complicated, but there were three ways to get your information from media, from networks. And, you know, you could think about it geographically. Of course, that effaced a lot of horrible things that were happening. But I just think of all the moments we've had moral clarity, obviously after the murder of George Floyd and things like that. And our society just mucks things up in a way so in a way I could not agree more with Ivan's point.
But our society is very complex, though. That's
I want to hear how Jonathan agrees with Ivan's point. Sorry, George, it's okay.
My point is, maybe because I've been studying the NRA for the past 10 years, that grassroots and running for local You start with the school board and you start with to the right's credit, like, they've been able to mobilize people around Second Amendment and around critical race theory and have angry people showing up to every school board and things like that. They pick kind of three things. And it wasn't just about CRT. It was about taking over school boards and defunding public education. And I just thought, like, where are the 10 zillion liberal people who are going to show up to the school board meeting and counter the angry CRT people in a way? And so I just think that I just could not agree more with Ivan's point that thinking about, everybody's like, oh, we should expand the Supreme Court. We should definitely do that. But we should also run for school board and election office, a monitoring office, and all these kind of things. You know, that ideology of kind of building things from the ground up, I think, is so important now, just given the way we've exceeded, we've exceeded capacity to kind of hold one narrative in our minds for more than 5 minutes in a way, unless it's, very, very personal.
I think that's so important because we can't even have a debate like George and I about because we're, even if we don't agree on what next steps should be, George is willing to, and we're all willing to say, okay, we'll examine the history though. Like, the Homestead Act was only for whites. The GI Bill, when you got, for mortgages, really was only for whites. Like, we can talk about the things that have changed, things that government programs that, for example, help the white community and that didn't help others. That's stuff that's going to be suppressed because of what Jonathan's saying. And, just education. I mean, having a really meaningful conversation about what fair and just reparations would be and who would feel bad about that and why and what, what it means to, as a society, what we want for people in the society as baselines, all that stuff would be really wonderful conversations that I don't think can even be had if everyone's not exploring the same set of facts. Before we leave, though, because we have to get on with our lives, even though it's very meaningful to have these conversations and think about this letter, I just want to ask folks to reflect on this one sentence that never grows old from the letter. Injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. We are caught in an inescapable network of mutuality, tied in a single garment of destiny. Whatever affects one directly affects all indirectly.
Oh, that's definitely right. True. We're a community and we see what men, not literally, but what mankind can do. And if it happens to me, right, it can happen to you. Look at what's going on with my reproductive rights. Maybe we'll start talking about your reproductive rights.
And strangely, you can also hear an echo of the justifications for U.S. foreign policy in sentence like that. Mm-hmm. It really does cut both ways. Is it our responsibility to fight injustice as we see it across the world? Or is it more of our hypocrisy to fail to address it in our own nation?
And it's a call for empathy, which is something that we are losing in our current environment. That was, again, that was the power of the letter, was that it was reaching out to the empathetic core of these clergymen and then of other Americans, white Americans, moderate white Americans and other Americans, and even the racists. And we don't have, today we've become too much of American society has become anti-empathetic. We don't want to listen to the other side. We don't, we don't want to hear about the history of it. We don't want, if you're talking about that, that's, I have to have a counter narrative that's not necessarily based in fact to oppose it instead of listening. And that's exactly what I think, and that's the opposite of the gospel. Of the New Testament, of the message of Jesus that Martin Luther King was trying to spread there. You have to put yourself in someone else's shoes to understand it. Even if you end up not agreeing on exact methods or you have to understand where the other person is coming from, and that requires listening and it requires rational discussion. And what he was doing through these nonviolent techniques was bringing that discussion to the table and forcing the discussion to be had on a rational basis, on a nationwide basis, on a worldwide basis at the table.
And also just how darn hard that is. I mean, I would invite listeners to try to write a letter like this in the present day, like write a letter to anti-woke crusaders or DeSantis or something like that. Like, I mean, we don't have that skill anymore to kind of humanize, and that's by design, right? In a way, it's a result of the 60s where, you know, there was a fear of the capitalist system that people would actually bring about change and there would be class unity and things like that. Like our system responded, but just try writing a letter like this in the present day to an ideology that you don't agree with. And just see how hard that is right now. I mean, I'm going to try it myself because I was thinking it as I was writing, like, what would it mean to actually try to write a letter like this to, like, an ideology I completely disagree with to further my own aims, which is what the letter is trying to do. And it's almost impossible. Like, either Twitter's ruined us or something like that. But it's really just the form of it, in light of what George was just saying, is so challenging to even imagine right now.
I feel like I'm so much more cynical because I'm imagining the clergy person I'm writing to is like Joel Osteen, you know, someone who I don't believe it, who I don't actually think is in it for anything other than money. And so, but maybe I could write, I mean, I feel like for some people, I don't know. I would have to think about, I think it's a great exercise. So I'm going to try to think about doing it even if I don't. That's my commitment. Thank you all for joining me today. I have a lot to think about, and I'm very grateful for this conversation.
Thank you for having me. And, you know, I picked out a good shirt for you, and you didn't even mention my shirt.
Oh, wait, we're not done yet. Wait, let's see. What are you wearing, Bridget? It says Black Superhero. I love it.
Awesome.
Okay, so I'm commenting on your shirt, a Black Superhero. Jonathan's wearing a tie because I think he had a more snazzy presentation to do today. George is wearing a button-up shirt, no tie. Ivan's wearing a V-neck knit shirt of some type, yeah?
Sweater.
We've got three pairs of glasses on the call. George, are you wearing contact lenses? Oh, there's cheaters. Those are readers, right?
All right, we're 5 for 5 now. No, these are real glasses. I'm wearing contacts.
Okay, I don't know. And, you know, I don't know where, no one, I see no windows anywhere because I know Bridget's in Springfield. Oh, Bridget's in Springfield. George, are you in New Jersey?
Yeah, I'm in Jersey.
He's in Jersey. Jonathan, where are you?
I'm in Nashville, Tennessee.
Nashville, Tennessee. Ivan, Manhattan or Brooklyn?
West Harlem.
West Harlem. How
are you in a hotel room, Jonathan?
No, I'm in my office.
You're in your office. Okay, so letter from a Nashville office.
Yeah, but I had so much stuff behind me, and when I heard you were going to comment, I had to like run and grab all the piles of papers. So there's like 9 piles of papers on the floor here.
I usually comment at the beginning, but then I got so excited about the subject matter.
What do I have on the floor here?
Oh, are there dogs? Wait, corgi. Oh, hi, baby. Ivan has a corgi too. He refuses to go on screen.
Yeah, he's hiding around here somewhere.
George, you have a cat also, I saw, no?
No, I do not have a cat.
Oh, that was a dog. What are you holding up? Is that some kind of tea, Jonathan?
No, my only contribution was a speaker gave me a bottle of Ouzo, so depending on where the conversation
Ouzo.
Went, I
thought we could all
have a drink afterwards.
Ouzo is the best.
That would be like letter licorice. from Birmingham Bar or something.
Yeah.
Well, letter from an Athens bar.
Oh, that would be great. Well, anyway, thanks, guys. I'd love to have any of you, you know, obviously my regulars, I always want you back, but Jonathan or Bridget, I may call on you again in the future to talk about your individual work or to join me in the book club.
Please.
So one comment here, we chewed up nearly 90 minutes on a 10-page letter.
Oh, wow.
Seriously, that's amazing. Yeah.
I could have continued that conversation for another hour, week, year. I think we need to keep having these discussions about the current injustice and where we want to go from here, how to make change. In the words of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., let us all hope that the dark clouds of racial prejudice will soon pass away and the deep fog of misunderstanding will be lifted from our fear-drenched communities. And in some not too distant tomorrow, the radiant stars of love and brotherhood will shine over our great nation with all their scintillating beauty. I'll be back next week with another show as we continue to explore the writing process and the nonfiction world together. Let us know what you think. Send me an email at bookedup@politicon.com or write to me at Booked Up, P.O. Box 147, Northampton, Massachusetts, 01061. To keep up with the show and our featured authors, follow Booked Up on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. And please give Booked Up a 5-star review. It really will help other people find the show.